through the passage here, and I'm going to make comments and just hopefully expand our understanding of this particular story. So, I'll begin right at verse 1 here. It says, "Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram." Does anyone know where Aram is or was? Yes! Boo. Okay. Oh, I should have read that translation. Yeah, Aram is modern-day Syria. Now, what's very interesting is the Arameans, there's Syrians, but there's also Arameans who live in Syria, and those are largely the Syriac Christians. So the Syriac Christians would be the descendants of the Arameans. And so that's something kind of interesting. So if you go to Syria, I mean, there's Syrians, but then there's Arameans, and odds are if you're meeting a Christian, he's from that ancestry. So this guy is from Syria. He's an Aramean, and that's him. Yeah. So we continue. "He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. And he was a valiant soldier, but he also had leprosy." Now, the Bible often uses the word leprosy. The thing is the leprosy here probably isn't the leprosy that we know of, where you lose all feeling and your hands start falling off and all that sort of stuff. The leprosy, they basically called anything was leprosy if it caused a skin disease. So if your skin started going crazy and flaky and white and, I don't know, right? Because they kind of viewed, because what they associated it with was death. Right, because when a body dies, its skin becomes pale and gross and meh, right? So if your skin was doing that, that was a sign of death, and so you were scary and dangerous, and that's why there was such a stigma placed upon people who had leprosy. So odds are, given that he's a military commander, he probably doesn't have the leprosy that's causing him to not have any feeling, but he has some sort of skin disease that is creating a significant, probably, social problem for him. Now, who was Naaman? Well, Naaman had everything. You know, you can see the adjectives here. He was a great man. He was highly regarded. He had victory. He had a great life. But he had leprosy. And you see, the Bible uses leprosy often, especially in the Old Testament, as a metaphor for sin. Leprosy was, and it could often be fatal depending on the type of disease it was. It was slow moving. It was terrible, it was inevitable, it was incurable, it created a big social stigma. And so what you have here is you have a great life, and yet this guy is dying. Something is eating him away. The Greeks, anyone ever read like a Greek tragedy? Have you ever, like Oedipus, do you know the story of Oedipus? The Greeks, I mean, you've heard of the term tragedy with a play and things. So you got comedy, like Shakespeare's tragedies, like Hamlet, or comedies and things like this. So the Greeks had this genre of tragedy. And what a tragedy was about a central figure who was not a bad man or woman. Usually is a good person. Sometimes is even a great person. And in fact, in many cases, right, these tragic heroes were highly regarded, but they had a tragic flaw. And the whole idea behind the Greek tragedy and most tragedies is a very profound insight into life, that no matter how great your accomplishments, no matter how great they are, no matter how much you can accomplish in life, no matter how many good things you can gain, no matter how impressive your efforts to put together a great life are, you have, and we all have, a tragic flaw, a spot of leprosy on the heart. And maybe it's pride, maybe it's jealousy, maybe it's an inability to take criticism or admit the truth at a particular crucial spot, the inability to control yourself, the inability to be courageous at a certain spot, maybe. And one tragic flaw often can ruin one's life, especially in the plays of tragedies. And the Bible basically says it's not just Oedipus or whoever, or Hamlet, what have you, whose life is a tragedy. Sin makes all our lives tragedies. You may be Naaman today. You know, you may have a nice house, an excellent job, everything's going for you, a good relationship, all sorts of things, right? You may have made it. You may be a Naaman, but you have leprosy. You carry within yourself the seeds of your own destruction. There is something wrong with our hearts. And that is one of the key messages of the Bible. All our lives are tragedies, no matter what happens. There is always this leprosy. And what's very interesting in this story is while Naaman has an external leprosy, we're going to learn that in his heart he has an internal leprosy. So then we continue. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel. And she served Naaman's wife, and she said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." You know, I find this is really cool here, because this young girl is taken from her home. I mean, this guy ripped her from her home, from her parents, from her family. You know, and a lot of people might have taken great joy in seeing their master suffer, because their master destroyed their life. And yet this, but not this little girl, not this young woman. I find that very interesting. I mean, that's a very good, she didn't let the bitterness of being taken from her home destroy her. Instead, she saw an opportunity where she could speak into her master's life and show him the true God in Israel. I find that quite fascinating, quite interesting. Oh, and sorry, I always forget. By the way, if you have questions, you can text me during the sermon. And we continue. So Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means, go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And so Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. And that's a lot of money. I'll just say it. It's just a lot of money. A significant contribution to the country of Israel. Or Samaria at this time. But, you know, what's interesting here is why does Naaman, who is told by the little slave girl there is a prophet in Israel, not actually go to the prophet? Did you notice that? She says, "Go to the prophet." And what does he do? He goes to the king. It's interesting. Anyone have any ideas why he would go to the king when he was told to go to the prophet? Well, he goes to the king of Israel, and he asks the king to cure him. That's what the letter says. But it's very interesting. The reason why he does that is because religion in that time and area was often a form of some sort of social control. Religion's not always used that way, but in this time period it often was. And the king was usually either seen as a god or as a mediator of the gods. And so here's what happened. The king would, you know, bankroll the whole hierarchy. The king would bankroll the priests and the prophets and the holy men and all the magicians and everything. And they were in his court, and he would bankroll them, and their job was to support the power structure. And his job was to support them. It was like, I scratch your back, you scratch my back. And so when you go to Pharaoh or when you go to Babylon or what have you, and you say, we have a problem, there's a dream to interpret, or there's a miracle to be done, you go to the king. And so the king summons everybody. And then they do their thing. They do what they're supposed to do. And so Naaman fell, of course, that's how you do it. You go to the king because the king is paying all the magicians to do what he wants. But the thing is that's not how Israel worked or was supposed to work. The king wasn't in control of God. There was a big distinction. God, the things of God, were completely separate from the king. So then we move on. The letter says, verse 6, the letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." So the king in this story is Jeroboam or Joram, and he's son of probably one of the most famous kings in Israel's history, King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. Have most of you heard of them? King Ahab and Queen Jezebel? They were kind of, there's this famous book that, I love the name, it's called Bad Girls of the Bible. Has anyone ever read that book? Bad Girls of the Bible. It's a great name. And it's about all the, like, bad girls of the Bible. And Jezebel's is often viewed as the worst woman in the Bible. So if you're having a child, do not name your daughter Jezebel. It'd be like naming, like if I named Alaric Adolf or something like that. You don't do that. So he's the son of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, and they had a big battle with Elijah, and we'll talk about him in a sec. And Ahab was the son of Omri. So Omri had started this new dynasty of kings in Israel, and Joram, his most famous achievement is that he lost that dynasty. He kind of messed it all up, and it went to another family after him. So he's he's not really a good king. Anyway, verse 7. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me?" So basically what the king thinks is going on here is that there's a big, it's a con job. He's looking for a casus belli. Do you know that phrase, casus belli? In Europe, when you wanted to declare war on someone, like in the medieval times, you had to have a reason, right? You know, like in a lot of video games, like Civilization or whatever, you can just declare war on people and just conquer people, just, you know. You know how the United States right now, there's all that debate about, oh, interesting, Syria, right? You know, should we just whatever Syria? And a lot of people are like, I'm not so sure about that. Should you be doing that? The reason is because a lot of people don't think the U.S. has a proper casus belli, which is a good reason to invade, a good reason to attack. Right, so what this king thinks is going on here is Syria or Aram doesn't have a good reason to attack Israel, but so they're trying to manufacture a reason. Look, we sent our general to go get healed by you, and you didn't heal him, so we're going to invade. Right, that's sort of what's going on here, and so the king's freaking out because he thinks this is some big huge con job. That's why he's because he's like, I can't do this. This is not how it works. I mean. You're a high general. You know, I just pay these guys to say I'm awesome. They don't really do anything, right? You know, so it's interesting. So then we get to verse 8 here. But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there was a prophet in Israel. And so Elisha was a disciple of Elijah, and Elijah was famous for battling the priests of Baal. And he had a bunch of power plays, and Elijah had this big battle with the priests of Baal to show that God was superior to Baal, and Jezebel hated Elijah, and it was this big battle, blah, blah, blah. And Elisha was a disciple of Elijah. So that's who Elisha was. So then we continue. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house, and Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored and will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and went off in a rage. So while the obvious problem with Naaman is leprosy, he has another problem. A problem that is stopping him from seeing clearly. And that is his pride. What's going on here? What are they doing? Why did Elisha treat him this way? What does God want to teach Naaman here? And I think that what's going on is they're after his pride. They're after his self-sufficiency. In other words, what God is saying to Naaman is, Naaman, there is a leprosy of your heart that is eating you up in a way that the leprosy of your body cannot. If the outer leprosy becomes the occasion for you to deal with the inner leprosy, then you can be saved. And the reason why the leprosy has to be his pride is because the treatment that Elisha is offering him is humbleness, humility, humbling him again and again and again. Pride is a leprosy. And pride is something, and self-sufficiency is something that is growing in every one of our hearts. And what it's doing is it kills us. It eats us up like leprosy. I heard a pastor tell this story about another pastor who went, he was asked to go speak to these 2 boarding schools in England. So he goes, and he speaks to both, and he's there to give a little message and then answer some questions for these 2 boarding schools. And the first boarding school, and he said it was very interesting. The first boarding school he went to, the kids were there, and they didn't really, you know, a school for the gifted, you know, like smart kids. And when it got to the Q&A time, the kids didn't really take it seriously. They kind of asked him, you know, those snooty questions where they aren't really looking for real answers. They just want to trip up the minister, like, can God create a rock so big he can't carry? And, you know, those type of silly questions that they weren't really into. They just wanted to trip him up. They didn't really care what the answer was. And then he went to the other school, which was geographically very close, also a school for the gifted, for kids who were just as smart, if not smarter, than the kids in the other school, except it was a school for kids with cerebral palsy. Do you know what that, do you have that, is that, it called that here? Yeah. So that's a disease where you're kind of, your hands are, your body is really weird, and you have trouble with your motor functions and other things. And he said, you know what was very interesting about that school was when the Q&A time came, it wasn't that they were more willing to believe or that they had a stronger Christian faith or anything like that, but you could tell from their questions that they really took things seriously. They really thought about the big things in life. I mean they would ask questions like, why would God do this to me? You know, and you know, it wasn't that they were believers, it was that they really appreciated the significance of asking important questions. And he said the thing that struck him about these two different schools is that the kids who had the world handed to them and had the world handed to them on a platter and a silver spoon in their mouth, they had this pride, this arrogance, and that they didn't really ever take the time to really consider the important questions in life. They felt so self-sufficient that they could completely rely on themselves, that they never had to turn to anyone. And so they had this sort of arrogance and about themselves. But these kids that came from the cerebral palsy school, they realized that life was hard. They realized that life wasn't easy. They realized that life throws you curveballs, that, you know, and that you have to rely on people, and that to be proud in a world that's so interdependent isn't a really good attitude to have. And he found that quite fascinating about these two different boarding schools and the different type of people that were contained in him. And so here, Naaman has a certain, I mean, he's a great general, he's a great man. And we're going to see how Elisha is attacking him at his pride here in a sec. Verse 13, Naaman's servants went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed? So see, first here, the simplicity of the cure offends him, because at this time, pagans expected grand ritualistic ceremonies. You know, he's expecting that I'm a great general, you're going to do some big, huge, like, hello, right? You know, like the crazy, woo, right? And Elisha's like, jump in a river, right? You know, no, I'm not doing some ceremony, just go jump in a river. Seven times, right? right, so Elisha, he's doing this to specifically attack the pride of Naaman. You know, and I think sometimes we forget the simplicity of the gospel. You know, we start to make it complicated. You have to do this, you have to do that. No, you don't. You know, you put your faith in Jesus. That's it. But then, of course, there are massive implications involved with that simple message. You know, the 2 plus 2 equals 4 is a very simple proposition, but there's massive implications for 2 plus 2 equaling 4. That you've, you know, the fact that you all had to probably take at least 13 years of math. Because of the truth of that proposition. But the message itself is very simple. Also, the freeness of the cure offends him. You know, we often want to be partners in our salvation. It's in our nature. We want control. Elisha says, no, just wash. And you know what Naaman is insulted about? This is probably what he's thinking. Any idiot can do that. What you're saying to me, O prophet, is that a person without any money, without any prowess, without any goodness, without any morality, without anything, can get this. Any idiot could do this. Which means, are you saying nothing about me matters a bit? Nothing about me can merit, can earn, or can attract the cure of God? Everything is worthless? And Elijah's saying, yep, everything. There's nothing about you that's special. That would get you this cure from God. And then finally, the exclusivity of the message insults him. He says, why not any river, he says. This is silly and narrow-minded. I mean, if that's the way it is to be done, you just wash. If it's really true, there's no difference, and nothing I have can do anything, why not anywhere? Why not in my river? And you see here the pagan mind, who is very offended, is a lot like our modern mind. You know, modern people are just as offended by the New Testament message of exclusivity as the pagan people were offended by the Old Testament message. The pagans felt every country had their own God. The pagans felt every people had their own God. And by pagan, I don't mean the derogatory pagan. That's just a technical theological term, in case you're wondering if I'm just calling people pagans. Yeah, you know, the pagans felt every people had their own god, that every river had its own god. There were many paths to God, and you could do it in any river. And modern people are just as offended by this idea. Why does it have to be this river? Why does it have to be this way? Why do we have to come to God through Jesus? The same thing. The same. He's offended by this. But don't you see now, Naaman? It's exclusive because it's simple and free. And if it's not exclusive, then it's not simple and free. In other words, they go together or they all fall apart. Let me explain. You know, most people say, I don't believe you have to be a Christian. I believe any good person can find God. Anyone who is disciplined, anyone who is moral, anyone who is seeking the good and the true, anyone who goes through things and does right, anyone who's really seeking. But don't you see what's going on in that statement? Your salvation isn't simple anymore, and it's not free. There is a difference now. The only way you can get out, the only way you can say there are many paths to God, is if you say good works will get you there. But then you have to deny grace to say there are many paths to God. There is a hidden exclusiveness in what you're saying. Don't you realize that? Because now what you're saying is, well, I think any good person can get to heaven or can reach God. Anybody who tries. In other words, what about the morally disabled? What about the person who has made a mess of their life and is now on their deathbed? What hope is there for them if it's only the good people who try? What about the child? What about the mentally disabled? What about, you know, all people who've had a really crappy upbringing, who just haven't had a chance in the world? What about these people? You see, if it's all about, oh, you just have to be a good person, well, then all of a sudden, you've totally taken the message of grace out of the gospel. And you've made it all about works, and you've basically condemned a whole bunch of people. In other words, you have an exclusivity, O pagan. You have a bias towards the strong, and a bias against the bad. But the gospel says, anybody can come, good and bad, strong and weak, as long as they're humble. There is an exclusivity to Christianity too. And so he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Oh, to have that water, huh? And the Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept the gift from your servant. And the prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept the thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. The story goes on for a bit if you're interested in how it ends. It's pretty cool. I encourage you to read on. But, you know, I remember this week as I was sick, you know, I thought about how I would do anything to do well. I remember I woke up in the middle of the night. It was like 3, 4 in the a.m., and I was shaking, and all I thought to myself was, I'm calling Bernie in the morning. you know, and I'm going to do anything he tells me, right? And that's what I did. I got up, I called his office as soon as I could, and I was like, is there any spot to see Bernie today? And they're like, no. And I'm like, please. Like, well, can you come like right at 9 or something? And I'm like, yes, I can come. But as I sat in my bed during this week, recovering and in pain, I thought about my real sickness, my spiritual sickness. And, you know, Bernie told me, he's like, you're not going to like this, but you're going to have to rest. You have to rest. You have to just stop. You have to rest. And I said, you know, yeah, I don't like doing that. I felt worthless this week because I couldn't do a lot of things. I couldn't help Charlotte. I couldn't do church stuff. I felt really worthless. And then it made me really think about my own spiritual sickness. You know, with my own spiritual sickness, with my own sin, do I really go to God for spiritual healing? Or do I try to rely on my own good works? I mean, why was I feeling so bad that I had to rest and couldn't go out and do all these things? And I started to wonder, do I place too much value? I mean, it's good to go out and do good things. I'm not criticizing that. But I was wondering, am I relying on that for my own sense of well-being? That I only feel forgiven because I do things. And it made me really realize, it was just something as I reflected on myself, is that no, it's not my works, it's purely the grace of God, and I just have to come to peace with, you know, if I lose the ability to do a lot of stuff because I'm sick or what have you, that doesn't change my worth in the eyes of God and in the gospel message. And so these are just some thoughts on the passage. Hopefully it expanded your understanding of the passage. And as we think about our own sin, let's reflect on that as we realize the forgiveness we have in the Lord's Supper and what it represents. So let us pray, and then we will partake. Lord God, I thank you for today, and I pray that that we would remember that your gospel isn't for just the strong, isn't just for the great in this world, but it's also for the weak, and that that there's no pomp and circumstance that we need to do to gain that grace, to gain that love, Lord. It's to acknowledge that you have done that for us, Lord, and to celebrate that. So I pray that you would continue to guide this church, and that this church would be a church that exemplifies the grace that we have in you. In your name we pray. Amen.